morning, everyone. Thanks for being in the hearing. Just well, before we get to you, we have a couple of questions of Mr. Bryce that we'd just like to deal with.
Right, I have two questions arising out of the memorandum filed submitted on Friday. The first is thank you for all the statistics on consents. You're going to tell us how many consents have been declined.
Yes, I realised that my error. I went back through my notes over the weekend and actually realised that I hadn't actually identified those, so I'll have to come back and confirm that additional to this. So when the council put this information together, they actually extracted that and removed it completely, so it shouldn't be too hard, so I'll come back to you and just confirm that. So apologise for that.
The second is, in your cut down matters for matters of discretion, you refer to reconfiguration of existing roads. Why existing roads? Why wouldn't it extend to roads proposed as part of the subdivision?
Well, it could be existing and proposed.
Thank you.
My questions arise actually having reread the notes that we made of the questions we asked of you the other day. And simply that many of the issues that we raised, the policies in particular, were that they were focused on urban subdivision and didn't seem to deal with rural. Have you considered the possibility that might, or would you like to consider the possibility that maybe the provisions be separated into a set of urban subdivision provisions and a set of rural subdivision provisions? The rural include the rural living zones and history. So.
Yes, I think it was the submissions from RCL actually provided that specific relief. They were seeking a quite definitive structure within the policy framework and the rule framework to reflect that. And certainly, there is merit in that approach. From a usability point of view, it would be a lot more transparent for end users to go directly to those policies that are of relevance to a particular area they didn't want to go.
Could I suggest, well, first of all, have you taken the opportunity to look at the decisions of the Auckland hearing panel on the unitary plan in respect of subdivision?
No, I haven't yet. No, I'll have to do that as part of my life report.
Well, the reason I raise it is that he came to that conclusion there and had separated them out completely.
Thank you.
That was the extent of this. That was well. Do you wish to summarise the rhythms of the
Look, well, I have a great length of time, so I won't go over it in too much detail. But really, I think the most important points for me now relate back to the legal submissions, which have provided a kind of response on behalf of Mr. Bryce. Some of the points I've put in the my statement of evidence, and there's an agreement on how these can be improved, these provisions, and particularly in relation to the objective point design, a lot of this is just around structure and format and purpose. But there remain some outstanding matters there that there would appear not yet to agreement on, and I thought it might be useful if I just talk to both boards that are listed in the legal position. And they are on page 15, 16 of the legal submission, which was circulated on 22nd of July. Just to give you a moment to find that. Meaning that reaching the minimum lot size can be hand down as part of Jack Point's idea of strict discretionary activity. And related to that, point B, where I proposed a policy in my evidence which expressly anticipated that there would be breaches of the minimum lot size. And really just to make it clear to process planners that that should not be treated as an exceptional circumstance to approve an application that would provide a smaller lot, so the minimum lot size was 380 square metres. Now, if I may just quickly circulate some images I have here, I just wanted to use this to demonstrate where I'm coming from. I've actually just taken the final page of the handout that's provided to you, where I've actually summarised the entry range required fire a rule in the proposed Jack's Point zone. And the key point, if I can take down that table to RHDE, is that the range of minimum of average lot sizes to be between 400 and 222 metres squared. So it's actually expressly at this point anticipated that there will be some quite small plots created. So I think it's quite appropriate that there is alignment on that front, and that the plan is clear and subject to good design and other considerations that those smaller lots be allowed to be created. There is some, and I'll quite scale this further, when the initial hearing of the technical design is a strong merit for providing efficient use of land from a landscape management perspective for the Waikato Basin in that area, given its ability to absorb change appropriately, and also from a affordability perspective. And in that handout I just provided you, I've given you some examples of the type of development in smaller lots that my client does anticipate. And these points were reasonably accepted in the hearing of nature before. I appreciate that they cannot be relied on necessarily, but again, we'll begin when it comes to Jack Point Zone. I can go on I can talk through these if you're interested, but in order to be brief, I'll just point out that you've got a range of different images here taken from Google Street View. Any of them from Victoria, and that's where my client does a lot of their previous work. A have, for example, more than anything now, 280 square metres, 155 square metres in some cases. Unfortunately, some of the later owners are under construction or they're in conceptual at this stage. I just really want to make the point that I believe that you can come up with quite an attractive streetscape, successful housing product on these small sections. And therefore, I would like to see the plan in terms of policy and the rules more expressly provide for restriction of discretion in the early stages. I accept that on smaller lots, the risks are designed to increase. I'm not asking that there's no minimum lot size and that it all should be a controlled activity. But I think there's considerable community benefit in enabling this type of development to proceed. And I can return to that in a moment to a few questions in relation to that. The final point that Mr. Price should not agree on at this point was in the point C in the legal submission from page 16, where he didn't accept that we should be striking through quite a number of the bullet points. And really, these, I've really just tried to approach this to try and simplify matters, to make it more concise, because I believe, as I proposed, that the methods of control or discretion that would be on smaller sites are actually sufficiently comprehensive, as recommended in my evidence. And initially, the model of duplication, really, and I was just looking at the compact town to make it more simple to administer, and trying to remove these distinctions between 380 metres and 450 metres square, etc., which have a history for them which I can explain necessary. But I just believe that the simplest thing to do is to just provide for those site methods of discretion and control in relation to all lots in the handing down part of the zone.
Mr. Bryce has suggested that where there is such a plan in place should be a controlled activity or subdivision. You agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
And Jack's point is subject to a structure plan. I'm not aware of the details of change 44 and there's a complication, of course, if that's changed for the operative plan and at some point they have to be brought together.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider it a simpler approach to include these issues of minimum average lot sizes and maximum average lot sizes within parts of Jack's point as part of the structure thing? And so compliance with, because the structure thing can include words and numbers, but not restricted to drawing. And I'm just wondering whether you consider that might be a way of dealing with that issue, because then they would fall within the controlled activity status and they wouldn't be breaching the minimum lot size because the structure plan provides for that.
Perhaps it does lead to an issue when talking about averages. You could achieve the average of lower 222 square metres in one of the activity areas, and that could involve very simply lot size 10 square metres or something ridiculous. Yeah, there needs to be perhaps a point where you need to be able to lift the space above control.
Or
in these smaller lots,
there can be an absolute minimum written into there. I mean, there is a point at which it gets too small, doesn't it? You should be going for apartments.
Yes, I'm not sure it is necessary really to do that so long as there's discretion, because as you say, you can go to apartments. I mean, some of these examples here, the non-negotiation thing, like how the boundary boundaries seems that the providers are continuing to innovate to provide the smaller areas. Look, if there were to be an absolute minimum, I would seek that it be potentially smaller than 850 square metres perhaps, but I prefer it's discretion retained in certain case-by-case budgets. And I believe that the fact that we need to achieve average across the board will disincentivise sort of extremely.
Could the table that you provided at the end, or something similar to it, actually also delineate the status or classification of the subdivision activity in relation to those numbers as part of the structure plan?
That table does sit in the checkpoint design, and it does specifically reference the structure plan. So it certainly speaking already does. I think it might be a restructure perhaps, but the position it referred to, I think. But as you say, I think it cannot be solely relied on. I do believe it also needs to be some particular attention to this more of some issue.
I only have 2 points. Firstly, a point of clarification, Mr. Wells. Going to paragraph 27 of your release. Three in the first two lines. The text of the subdivision guideline proposed to be incorporated. What do you mean? I didn't understand it.
I imagine you're aware of what we're talking about here, the guideline that was to be incorporated.
Yes, I'm aware of the existence of the subdivision guidelines here in our group.
What I mean is that there is a number of principles set out in the words in that guideline, which appropriate. In my view, that principles of good subdivision design.
Oh, you mean the content?
The content is fine.
That's all I need to understand. When you say text, you mean the content of the subdivision guidelines?
The written content, I just had a little submission with the drawing, I thought, where it did not match up well with what was written.
Now, another point of clarification, your suggested new policy, 273.13.3, subject to appropriate design controls being in place. Now, my question is, what does that mean?
There is a mechanism provided for through wording the checkpoint zone where on small lots there in the hand-me-down part of the zone, a number of the general standards in terms of setbacks, precision planes, all those kinds of things, they're actually exempt. The smaller lots are exempt from those, and the mechanism anticipated and provided for is that those be established as part of subdivision consent, most likely as consent notices, so that there's controls imposed in that manner. Having said that, I do think that really probably can be improved.
Is that in terms of the hand-me-down provision in terms of change 44?
Yes.
That's not before us, though.
Oh, it's also in the proposed text on the card.
Right, yes. So it's in the proposed statement.
Yes. Just to return to your point, Commissioner Robinson, there, that subject to appropriate design control being in place it probably could be something like subject to appropriate design outcome being achieved. Something like that.
Does the gap point zone include policy that deal with the design issues that you're referring to?
I don't actually have it in front of me. I believe so.
Would it be appropriate for cross reference or something that to cross reference for the zone provisions so that it's quite clear that the subdivision design we're talking about in relation to the zone provisions?
Like wording of instance that comes to mind. Subject to design controls that achieve the objectives and policies of the zone.
That would well be more appropriate than what I was using here.
And the, having said those two questions, I in fact thought of a third while we've been going. While we were discussing matters with Mr. Bryce last week, we were canvassing the possibility, not in relation to Jack's point, but in relation to other roads, of some flexibility around minimum lot sizes, and in this comparison is drawn with subdivision control over the coverage controls, where typically there is a standard and then there is an enlarged standard which is more restrictive, and then above that then it defaults to an even more constrictive. Is this going to use that kind of control to fit your point?
To an extent it is. What I propose is you have control and then below 380 commercial distribution unit, and I guess there is a what might follow is that perhaps you go physically that becomes non compliant perhaps. And yes, I think this is scope to do with it wouldn't overly concern me so long as that non compliant level was not seen level, given the example that I've provided here. I think I've talked about why I was convinced it's necessary, but I could make just a broader comment that in general, I think flexibility around the lot size can be a constructive outcome in terms of the new district plan. So sometimes minimum lot sizes can become very rigid.
Thank you, sir.
Thank
you, Mr. Farrell. It might be handy if you told Mr. Goldsmith, but it appears the next person is not alive, so he might get a ruling. Oh no, she's here. You're on now.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay.
I was waiting outside.
questions for the minister?
My name is Julie Nesbitt, and my husband Ron and I operate Lady Farm Lodge, located at 465 Lady Farm and Highway 6, opposite Cowles Drive, leading into St. Kate's Estate. Through the subdivision of our rural area on Lady's Mile, we have a dramatic effect on our ability to operate our pit lodge and will result in using the community. I make reference to map 1, shows the location of the intended proposed subdivision along Lady's Mile. In reference to map 2, just recently the Sanderson Street and the Stalker family and Mr. Tilden have applied for a special housing area to develop in our rural area on Lady's Mile. We report that the huge implications these proposals will have on the rural environment required to operate our pit lodge, should they be successful and gain the resources to do so. At no time have we been asked by the developers to give input into the possible effects of these subdivision proposals or the effects that it would have to operate our pit lodge and all ways to remedy them. If they wanted to establish a good rapport moving forward, we would have expected good communication from the onset. The developers are clearly not concerned about the effects their proposals will have on our pit lodge operation or on our rural environment. Map 3, taking the Stalker family and Mr. Tilden's proposed special housing area plan as an example, we note that the pit lodge does not feature on plan. Your information showing the pit lodge location. The density and close proximity to houses around the pit lodge, the closest being approximately 80 metres, has no regard for any sensitivity issues. And a cycleway walkway trail leading from the subdivision onto our property, actually right into our tenant facility. The intention of opening up the paper road to access the subdivision on State Highway 6. In reference to map 4, this map shows the location of our pit lodge in relation to the unfinished paper road. Please note that the dog motel is 2.5 metres from the paper road. The kennel facility is approximately 7 metres from the paper road. And we're 26 metres from Trail Highway 6. We're also 70 metres from the junction of Trail Highway 6 and Howard Drive. Leading into located space. In reference to map 5, we've been advised by NCTA that to provide safe passage for traffic from the subdivision, a roundabout would be required. If the roundabout was placed at the junction of State Highway 6 and Howard Drive, it would require about a third of our property. And as a result, in the removal of our kennel facility and our driveway leading into our property. The close proximity of traffic using the roundabout and traffic accessing the Stalker Tilden subdivision would therefore make the operation of our pit lodge impossible. In conclusion, future subdivision along Lady's Mile will dramatically degrade our rural environment and have adverse effects on the operation of our pit lodge business. The lack of consultation from adjoining landowners only reinforces the need to have a resource consent process that does not disadvantage those that would be adversely affected, like ourselves. We therefore request that all subdivision in our rural area be discretionary activity. And for your information, I've included the submission from stage 1 that we gave, process of case, which together with this submission gives an understanding of the service that we provide to the community and a reinforcement of the need of a rural environment to operate our pit lodge.
Thank you. Commissioner Stevens, do you have any questions?
Yes. Just by looks of those maps, it certainly looks that way. Or does that paper road mean that you don't actually share boundary with the Glen Panel proposal, or do you share a boundary?
What do you mean?
We do not share a boundary with Glen Panel. The separate road is right in between.
In between. Okay, and just on another matter, it's been talked about a master plan for the Lady Mile Strip for future development. Have you got any knowledge of that or any thoughts regarding master plan Lady Mile?
In regard to it becoming an urban area?
What does future development in general, whether it would be urban or rural lifestyle?
I'm aware of it. I'm aware of it, but I guess from our point of view, we're actually quite shocked to think that we could go from rural to urban just like that. Do you mean in regard to the special housing accord?
No, not so much. Just it's part of this process to plan the master plan or the plan.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused, I guess, because I guess when we started the hearings for the proposed district plan, we thought that we were looking at rural and the special housing accord. Basically, the reporting requirements in our area, and we thought, well, how could that be that we go from rural to looking at an urban area? We can't move our teplush. It is impossible to relocate that teplush in Queenstown. Once that teplush goes, there's no way that we're going to ever get that teplush back. So basically, well, if we end up in an urban area, well, I just don't see it actually being a situation that we can rectify. I mean, NTT have told us that to accommodate that amount of traffic, even if they don't get the resources then to develop that intense route next to us, that there will have to be some form of ability for traffic to come out of that junction. We're having horrendous problems at the moment with traffic at 10 hours to change one of our driveways. And we're also concerned about Sanderson's proposal that they view that there shouldn't be any changes to that junction given that most of those retirees won't come off the property. I actually expect that. I know a lot of those people who have looked at the list of them, that they're actually quite mobile, they've got their own vehicles. And the suggestion NZTA is just to extend the right checking bay into Howard's Drive. We know how difficult it is to get out of there and coming across three lanes of traffic. A lot of that traffic pulls into our slipway and our driveway, waits for that traffic to go past to come back out. So we've got issues already now. Without even that development looking at being
Okay, thank you.
And also that kennel facility can't be moved to any other part of the property. It actually has a full extent of virtually right from the back of our property. It's got a little bit of lawn at the back which is by the cottage, but
thank you. Mr. Robinson.
No, I don't have any questions.
No, I don't have any. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The issues of concern by clients can be fairly clearly set out in the evidence presented and in the written legal submissions. We can keen to minimise any unnecessary repetition. So, especially with our legal submissions, I'll take those as read. And just to highlight some things in this presentation. I say that prime issues of concern are potentially now resolved. And I say potentially not just the final decisions from the hand of the Commission, but specifically the latest council proposals to remove discretionary control over lot size in zones where a minimum lot size is prescribed deals with 90% of the issues that were raised in the evidence, probably deal entirely with the issue of their representation of the valuation evidence. I've noted and have received this morning the latest information from taken by Mr. Bryce over the weekend.
Yes, my apologies, Mr. Goldsmith. Unfortunately, I arrived at the council on Friday, and our assistants were both on leave on Friday afternoon. It wasn't until Sunday that I realised that it hadn't been distributed to you. My apologies for that.
I don't intend to take any moral high ground at the time of lodging the documents, Mr. Chairman. I found it, but the one thing I did find interesting about it is that it appeared on day 3 of this hearing that the council actually finally managed to find one single example of the part of the regime not working properly. And I note with interest that the footnote of case referred to is actually one of mine.
Well, I have some other aspects of that same situation that I was going to raise with you if you persisted.
So, due to the late receipt, I didn't have time to dig out that decision to read it. Puzzling that this from memory, I thought our issue here was a road of legal work which didn't meet the council's code of standard.
No, I think.
But I accept if there was an issue here, if I can cut the chase, if there was an issue there, as raised in Nigel Bryce's supplementary, which is there, I accept that I can assume no difficulty with council having control over the lost license of the road and sex services. That's not the issue. So, if there's a legal reason for council to have that specified as a matter of control, whether under control, a poor control activity CA, decision activity RDA, if there's a valid reason for council under CA or RDA to have control over lot size for roading access service easements, that's not an issue.
Just picking up on that, Mr. Goldsmith, take it to the extent. Your concern, put bluntly, is that that not be used as a basis to leverage a broader reservation of control.
Correct. And the last word is specifically, I admit it. I come on with it later to an example of why that concern is there, just in case it's still a violation. So, assuming the panel ends up agreeing with that restricted discretion over lot size, the remaining issue is really one of principle is in the CA versus RDA, as much as I think is of substance. I'll we'll address that. I find that my introduction that you'll appreciate has run through the submissions. I agree with both Mr. Brown and Mr. Fowle, and Mr. Fowle relied on Mr. Brown's evidence to a large degree, so we come to questions if you want a hot tub and have us together, I'll leave that entirely up to you. Point two, what I call a philosophical comment. I go back, formed all the time, when we come to planning that, we have a situation where one of the ideas the council has full control over what people do with their land, and the landowners are very simply constrained by council guidance and discretion. The RMA, in one way, reverse that process and introduce that. You can do what you like with your land unless the council, through a whole detailed process, comes up with some reasons for controlling it. And it kind of swung the pendulum, in my submission, significantly from council control to landowner. My experience over 25 odd years since the RMA was implemented, the councils have announced a rear guard action seeking to get back the control they used to have. There's always been that tension between councils and landowners and subdividers over who makes decisions about what happens to land.
Isn't that philosophical point? Even with section 9, not section 11. Under the Local Government Act, the control of subdivision was probably akin to a discretionary activity that we have now. But section 11 has no presumption of a right to subdivide, does it?
I accept that section 11 has no chance of the right to subdivide, but section 11, as with section 9, is subject to, you know, the section 52 regime of when you bring in rules and judgments and policies and rules in particular, so cost efficient and cost effective and so on and so forth. So, although the starting presumption is the process you have to go through to end up with your regime of judgments, policies and rules, is the same in the sense of having to test them, and against section 32 analysis regime, and in terms of not imposing a greater level of control than is necessary to achieve the right outcomes.
I'm not sure that if the starting point in section 11 is that there is control, I'm not sure that that analysis of section 32 necessarily holds true. I discussed this with Ms. Scott the other day as well. It was her submission that the starting point is different. If you were to make it less restrictive, then clearly that is different from making it more restrictive. And even moving to a restrictive discretionary activity from the starting point in section 11 is making it less restrictive, isn't it?
Making it less restrictive from the starting point, but you can't subdivide without consent.
Well, not by default, according to the Act, as it's written now, that's the discretionary activity.
It's a discretionary activity to the extent that you need council consent to subdivide.
Well, no, there's a specific room in the Act which says anything that's in nominal for the discretionary activity. So section 11, without something in the plan, is a discretionary activity.
I don't believe that takes away from the point I'm making, is that from however you define the site, you have to go through a process to arrive at a planning regime. The process is up to section 32, and that process drives you to an outcome which is bluntly, the council should not impose controls, which also not may impose costs and efficiencies, unless those controls are justified to achieve identified environmental outcomes and to the extent that they are necessary to achieve environmental outcomes. I'm not sure that the starting point makes a huge amount of difference if we have to go through the same process to end up with your rules. Anyway. That's my comment. I think councils, unless you give me a plan change, I've been involved in the main useful type of issues. Councils are sought to take back control, and that has led to debates over discretion and uncertainty. And point three is really a summary of what is covered in the evidence and my legal submissions that I can go to fix it. we have a regime that has been working for at least the last 15 years. There's certainly nothing in my submission and any of the documentation today which identifies any problem arising out of having a controlled HCA regime as opposed to an RDA regime. Now, maybe some hearing arose, in which case I'll have to reconsider. But on the Section 32 documentation and all the council members, for reasons expressed in the evidence by the witnesses in that brief, nobody has identified in my submission a single aspect of the current CA regime which needs fixing and which doesn't work. And in saying that, my legal submission, I'm not talking about beforehand. I'm not talking about this kind of funny reverse silly way of finding out what you're saying. I know that's confusing, I know it's complex, it should be fixed, but it hasn't been fixed. No, I'm talking substantive.
The reason that I raised the last one, today's situation, is not to do with the access of Hatfield Road. It was to do with the fundamental problem that was created by the subdivision of the Fires Terrace, that any sensible planner would have ensured that access was provided to 9,000 square metres of low density residential land that could only be accessed from the Fires Terrace when that subdivision occurred. Now, I don't know the details of when that subdivision occurred, but if it was under the controlled activity regime, that provision couldn't be made.
Interesting. I see your point.
And my concern is that if we're trying to encourage more urban development and assist us, we don't want to end up with the council not having the ability to ensure that access is provided to adjoining land which may otherwise become landlocked and unusable.
Given my agreement with the rules of the others, you may not need to break this.
No, but that's
yes. It's certainly always in my understanding that the council has always had over requiring access and services through the land density development.
Yes, strictly speaking, we can't reduce the number of lots, can we? A controlled activity condition can't reduce the number of lots.
Simplistically, shall we say, under the current CA regime, if a subdivider in a block of land came to council with a subdivision plan to create 50 lots with 2 metre wide road access, it would be my submission, it's my submission that the council has the power under this controlled activity regime and that subdivider was dogged, determined, wouldn't change his plans despite all the consultation with the council and everything else. I mean, if it happens, so let's just assume the original invited somebody up there to try to do that. My suspicion is that the council, under the regime, is able to issue a consent in a condition that says prior to this 223 approval, the consent holder will produce an amended subdivision plan which requires the council.
That's a consequence of the condition. I can understand that power in section 106 only applies to sites lost within the subdivision, as it applies to land beyond the subdivision.
My point was about a road within the subdivision.
Yes.
It's 2 metres wide. Forget connections. I'm saying
I understand that.
If you get 106, in my position under the control activity regime, then the council can require the rest of the way. And I I've always been of the understanding, although I feel like I've thought about it, that the council has always had the power to require connections to unsupervised land. But so if you're given on that front as well, maybe you don't think you should make that decision. So, apart from any other symptoms, I'm not aware of any problem, any evidence presented by the council that supports the contention that the current CA regime doesn't want to work, albeit perhaps it can be improved in terms of adding urban design assessment criteria and like. I didn't know about Paul referred recently to Mr. Falconer's summary paragraph 8 where he makes the comment that he's reviewed statements of sort of evidence and no evidence of evidence has been filed by submitters. To the extent that Mr. Falconer presents urban design evidence, I'm happy with that statement. So does he, for example, assesses the council's subdivision design guidelines. That's urban design expertise, urban design evidence, no problems with that. But in paragraph 5, he says, I believe that the proposed recommendation that Mr. Bryce would make subdivision as RDA will provide the required improvements to greater surety of quality outcomes. That's not urban design evidence, that's planning evidence. How urban design outcomes are delivered through a planning regime by CA or RDA is the arena of the planner of the urban design expert. So my submission is Mr. Falconer's evidence doesn't lend support to CA versus RDA. It doesn't fit in the evidence. And Mr. Bryce's summary, I refer to paragraph 5, which is the one in this paragraph where it talks about the censorship consents that have been granted. And again, I note that the updated information presented today updates that information to some extent and provides some additional information about the censorship with respect to Mr. Bryce. I think he's possibly missing the point that I'm making here. One has to be very careful with statistics. The first point I comment on is that those statistics rate consent numbers rather than lot numbers. Now, for example, the whole of Jack's Point is controlled. It's been processed under a control agency in Beijing. Probably under four consents, so 4 or 5 residential plots. Each plot has 1 consent. It could have been done in 1 consent. That consent could have consented 500 residential lots. So, if we're going to try and use statistics, we might look at the number of residential lots consented through an RDA, through a CA regime, not the number of consents. Just depends on these numbers. The second point, which I did cover in my written submission, which I want to emphasize, is the difference between individual RDA triggers and a global RDA trigger. So, which is the RDA, a global RDA trigger. What I've been advanced is a global RDA trigger. So, getting this into globally RDA, there's a whole bunch of things to look at. The current regime is very different. The current regime has a series of parts of the thing, different site standards where they're needed under each section. And then we have earthworks, we have this kind of weird thing on earthworks, which confuses
everyone.
For the benefit of Mr. Robbins, other than himself, as you'll know, Pearson's Park 15, this district plan was put out, it's operated as a college. It sits there on its own, and if you're controlled or RDA under the Park 15, you need to go to the district plan. In 2 years, up until about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the council reinterpreted this district plan and discovered that due to an unintended consequence of some provisions, if your subdivision reached the land use earthwork standards, residential zone 100 cubic metres, if your subdivision reached the land use earthwork standards, you needed the land use incentive. that change, fundamentally change the status of literally every subdivision. Actually hard to build a subdivision, especially on the flat land and not building much road where you don't pick up or shift 100 units of earth. So a whole swathe of consent went from CDA to RDA, a CA to RDA. But they're only RDA in relation to earthquakes. And the council can only, on those consents, can only refuse consent on the grounds of earthquakes, which is never the truth. This is always a solution. So, yes, a lot of the existing consents are RDA, but they're individual, what I call individual RDA. Another example is for a current plan has a site standard on water supply with some things you have to comply with. That's actually a carry forward within the extent of a public thing that proposed there. If you trigger an RDA on water supply, yes, your whole consent with RDA is a bundling, but the council could only refuse consent for the water supply. And as long as you solve the water supply problem, in fact, if you were globally RDA, actually developed. You are RDA for water, and you are effectively controlled for the rest. So, this issue of the numbers of current consents, of consent under the current regime, which are RDA rather than controlled, is actually potentially quite misleading. And it's the move from a regime which triggers RDA on a specific issue, and only that issue, to a regime which is where everything's RDA, the whole consent's RDA, and everything in it's RDA, is quite a significant change.
My question arising from that, Mr. Goldsmith, is that looking at those statistics and taking on board the old story about lies, down lies and statistics, that I tend to take more notice of the split between controlled and RDA on the one hand and discretionary and non-complying on the other, because as you say, with RDA just on earthworks, it's going to be almost invariably, if not invariably, granted, because as we know, there is always an engineering solution for virtually any earthworks problem. And the split seems to be sort of 50-50. It might be 49-51, as I say, between what we might say the other more restrictive and less restrictive, putting RDA with control. So, if they take them on board, there's still a substantial number of consents that have obviously been processed that are on a completely open basis, if not non-complying. So, which suggests to me that, well, is that posing a huge problem to the developer community? The fact that there are so many consents in that phase?
Well, it's
a
good question. I know both the residential zone, the rural residential zone, is about 50-50.
Rural lifestyle is a...
Yes.
Yes.
And... It's difficult to answer. I think what's difficult to answer clearly without knowing why they were discretionary or non-compliant. This is why an analysis which set out why they were there would actually help inform an answer. But then my starting point, and the third thing is, I actually think, the first point I made about the numbers of loss created could well be significant. And from my experience, big developers doing a lot of lots end up at which to try and work on discretion and non-compliant. So I don't know what the numbers are, I don't know what the reasons are. But my starting point of principle is that if the landowner wants to apply to something that is restricted, that is for some reason discretion or non-compliant, it's a landowner's choice. And he may want to achieve something, whatever he wants to achieve, whatever the reasons were. If he wants to choose to go to a more difficult route, he's fully entitled to do so. That, in my submission, doesn't justify taking away from him the easy route. starting point is for most mission, is an easy route, cold activity, tolerable rules, you know you're going to get it, council's got discretion over a whole bunch of things. Go the easy route, fine. If you want a little bit more difficult route, you can choose to. But you shouldn't lose the easy route. But the half that enjoyed and were able to use the easy route should lose it because of the half that decided to go the difficult way.
I understand that point, but I think that's a slightly different point. You're starting from the premise that if it is not broke, don't fix it. As I say, if half, approximately, of the number of consents, take on board your point, that we don't know how many lots sitting behind an individual consent, doesn't your planning evidence rebound against you that this isn't producing an insuperable problem?
Yeah,
well,
that line, why this
discretion on compliance, it's kind of quite hard to ask that. Well, but equally, that's why I, in my own mind, put restricted discretionary in the controls, because whatever the reason why they became discretionary or non-compliant, once they're there, then all issues are up for grabs.
I see. The other half, they're not. And then the other half, it really comes out to go, if we get to where we've got to with counseling, at this point the principle is only really, given what we've got left, what the discretion is you've got left, why is it the council needs this desire to be able to refuse to see? And no one appears to have a right problem, other than almost fear of the unknown. There might be something out there that may lead us to want to refuse consent, even though we can't identify the point of it. Therefore, we should have anybody to refuse consent. I'm saying, in a district like Queenstown, which is under such a half rule that West Hill and Fisher are anywhere in New Zealand, and maybe that's part of the reason that in Queenstown makes half of the discretion of non-compliant. A little bit of fun, push the boundaries, get a bit more, so that's kind of half of course, almost, made this the rest of the life. But if half of them are going to be RDA or control, then it's a simple question. Why do they need the RDA? Why does the house need to be able to refuse to see? Simple
thing. Is that a convenient point to break?
I'll finish point five. That's
yeah. Okay. We will adjourn until 11:45.